Hey y'all, before we jump into today's episode, we would like to invite you to a special event we're hosting on May 30th called Women in Whiskey. Join us for an adult field trip filled with Southern fun at the Jack Daniel's Distillery right here in our home state of Tennessee. Get ready to learn while sipping. We will be taking a private tour of the distillery, enjoy a barbecue lunch on the beautiful hillside, and partake in early happy hour with cocktails provided by Jack Daniel's as we listen in on a conversation with women who work in the industry. The conversation will be led by yours truly, your hosts of the Steel Magnolias Podcast. Learn more about the event at steelmagnoliaspodcast.com. You can grab your tickets there, and we cannot wait to see you on May 30th. And now, on with the show. Today, we're discussing the show that made country music famous. The Grand Ole Opry is world famous and originated right here in our hometown of Nashville. With an ever-changing lineup of musicians, each performance is broadcast to a global audience via WSM Radio, Sirius XM, and Circle. We got to sit down with our dear friend, Sean Dietrich, to discuss his debut Opry experience. So join us at the table as we discuss the gem that still makes Music City grand. Welcome to the Steel Magnolias Podcast. We are two sisters here to have uplifting conversations about life in the South.
The South is full of beautiful diversity in landscape, people groups, and culture, and we want to showcase each part. We've got plenty of room at our table, so pull up your chair.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Laura Beth.
And I'm Lainey.
And we are so thrilled to get to cover the Grand Ole Opry and talk to our friend Sean Dietrich towards the end of our conversation. You really can't give the Grand Ole Opry the gravitas that it
deserves.
It's due. Yeah. We're going to be celebrating 100 years next year. 2025 makes 100 years of the Grand Ole Opry.
Wow.
The building that it's in now is celebrating 50 years this year. So they did the sweetest celebration in March, just last month, where they even had a couple performers that were there the original night 50 years ago.
Wow.
I believe Bill Anderson and Connie Smith were a couple of those performers. So this is just going to be such a great conversation. Let's jump in. Let's talk history. Let's just... Yeah.
And even modern day stories, too.
Yes, yes.
So our parents got established in Nashville in 1971, and so many things, I think, gosh, they've watched so much change. But the Grand Ole Opry was already very established by 1971.
Well, okay, great that you brought that up, that, you know, our parents being here, because I kind of wanted to start our discussion of America's longest running radio show. Hello.
That is amazing.
We've got history to cover. But I kind of wanted to start it in an unusual place.
Okay.
I want to talk about the transmitter, the radio transmitting tower that you and I have driven by in Brentwood, Tennessee all of our lives.
Yes. And didn't you just even recently, we were talking about, Jacob made some comment about it being a spaceship or a rocket or something?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Like, we drive by this thing.
And it, you know, I mean, it transmits more than the Grand Ole Opry, but that is special that you can drive by this. And y'all, it is massive. So it was put up. In fact, at one point, it was the tallest broadcast tower in the U.S. It was originally 878 feet tall. Its height was reduced in 1939. It went up in 1932. But it was reduced a little bit. But the tower was commissioned by WSM AM, which that's the radio station that we're talking about today, which was a Nashville radio channel famous for originating the Grand Ole Opry in 1925. In 1931, the station was federally designated as one of 14 national clear channels and was thus granted the ability to reach 40 states and transmit at full power at night.
Okay. Well, I had jotted down in my notes in reading that the WSM tower, the prior tower that they were using,
yes.
So this show was established in 1925. Was 1,000 watts.
Okay.
And I think in 1925, that was pretty good.
Was that a big deal? Okay.
But in 1932, it went to 50,000 watts.
So that's via this tower that I'm talking about.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the program's audience at that point expanded dramatically, which is a big deal of why this show went so far and has gone so long. That's why you wanted to start here. The tower at that point blanketed most of the nation, and the show gained supporters in almost every state. By 1936, I just think this is a cool little fact, the Opry generated 80% of WSM's weekly mail.
Oh, like people writing
that
in.
That were writing in. This was
oh
the buzz
gosh.
Show. This was the big deal.
That's the buzz around the
Grand
the country,
Opry,
I guess
right.
I should say. Not really quite around the globe yet. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it matters that people recognize that the Grand Ole Opry isn't just famous for the sake of the stars that it produced. It's famous for that, for sure. But it's famous for the way that it truly transmitted the sounds, the country and gospel
yes.
sounds that were coming off of this stage. So, I mean, you kind of could even say we wouldn't be Music City.
For sure we wouldn't.
Like, people wouldn't know us as Music City. Maybe the Middle Tennessee, Southeast region, maybe. People that had traveled here and experienced it live and in person, maybe they would associate it all. But if you don't get here.
Right. And there wouldn't be, yeah, it was the thing that brought the publishers, that brought the everything else that surrounds the music industry of Nashville, mm-hmm. that all came because of.
Right.
That's what I think is important
yeah.
to say.
Yeah.
And for the young millennial listeners and even younger that listeners, you have to even think back to a time you can't even wrap your mind around. And that is no phones, no yeah. television.
No television. Right.
We're talking about the family surrounding the radio.
Yeah.
To hear
yes.
your entertainment. That's how you got your entertainment. You weren't, I mean, that's a whole nother age.
Yeah. And this did have strong appeal to the millions of rural American families that existed all across the country.
That's right.
And still exists today. I mean, it's but it just
For
has
sure.
even wider appeal
I'm gonna
today.
I'm going to touch on that again in a little bit.
Well, just to wrap up, that transmitter, that tower, has been recognized and is added to the National Register of Historic Places. It was given
wow.
that recognition in 2011.
That's fun.
So, you know, it's recognized for all the reasons that we just talked about. And radio
cool.
is so powerful. So let's kind of go through maybe just the early
Years. Well, again, America's longest running radio program. That's unbelievable. And it's coming up on its 100th anniversary.
I know. I wonder what they're going to do to celebrate.
I know. That's got to
be there.
A lineup that's going to be worth seeing. Well, the father of the Opry was George D. Hay, who came to WSM in November of 1925. I got some great information again from my Encyclopedia of Southern
culture.
It's such a great book. Prior to this, he had been at Chicago's WLS and had helped announce their show, The Barn Dance. And it was a program that inspired country radio jamborees nationwide. So it was, you know,
okay,
kind of the first, and then lots of those kinds of shows started to appear. Anyway, by the year's end, in 1925, after he had come to WSM, he had organized the talent into a regular Saturday night show, simply known as the Barn Dance.
Okay.
They had yep. all kinds of performers, Hawaiian groups, minstrel acts, military bands, but the old-time string bands was what soon prevailed.
Okay.
That's what
surfaced
were.
As yes. the fan favorites.
So he kind of shaped the Opry into a folksy but highly commercial production that appealed to a broad-based audience of rural and small-town listeners, just mm-hmm. like you said, scattered throughout the nation. And he gave the band, those string bands, names such as Possum Hunters or Fruit Jar Drinkers and kind of urged them to wear these, you know, country costumes and things like that. And he became known as the Solemn Old Judge.
Yeah.
That was kind of like his persona.
Yes.
Let's talk about the name, the Grand Ole Opry.
It is kind of a funny name.
Funny name,
yeah.
right? So there was a show that was prior to the Barn Dance show that was Music Appreciation Hour. It was a classical program that was carried on Saturday night. And in 1927, this George Hay said, "For the past hour, we've been listening to music taken largely from the Grand Opera. But now we will present the Grand Ole Opry." Like, he just kind of said that in a, like, a cute way.
So he literally came up with the word Opry.
Yeah.
I mean, that word did not exist. So he did introduce 77-year-old fiddle player Uncle Jimmy Thompson. That was who was the very first performer on this new show.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So him being a program director, you know, maybe he recognized talent. Maybe he's like, this is the guy I want to start with. Maybe that's just who had a hot single at the time.
So that was the first, in 1925, that was the first person to play.
Yes. The Barn Dance. You know, it was the Barn Dance show.
Yeah.
The WSM Barn Dance. Yeah.
How cool.
A fiddle player.
That's amazing.
Seems apropos. Yeah. And that would have been this George Hay. He would have been broadcasting from the National Life and Accident Insurance Company building. That's where they
That's
would
have, where WSM had their...
That's where their location was.
That's right. That was the first...
yeah.
First hub.
Yeah. So they looked for larger venues, and they played all around town. They played the War Memorial, which is still a venue today here in Nashville, very close to our capital. That's still an auditorium that bands play today. They played there for a little while. They played a tabernacle called the Dixie Tabernacle in East Nashville.
Oh, a different tabernacle.
Yeah. Exactly. I know. And then they landed at the Ryman Auditorium. And in 1943, that's when they moved into the Ryman Auditorium, which, just as a side note, is a very unique place with history far before the Grand
Ole. The Gospel Tabernacle.
Yes.
Was what it was called.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before.
So it, you know, it... dates 1895, the Ryman Auditorium does. And it came out of a revival that was happening here in our city. But 1943, they move in, and they played the Ryman for over 30 years. Yeah, I think it was 31
years. 31 years. That's what I had in my notes, too. Wow.
So many people still really call the Ryman Auditorium the Opry House.
Yes.
Like,
and
our dad
does, very
for sure.
Special place, and it doesn't matter who you go see, it can be like the coolest rocker, they still almost you almost always hear them say, "I can't believe I'm standing where Hank Williams sang," or "I can't believe I'm standing where you know, Dolly Parton sang."
Yeah,
it's like they just know how to not give a nod to the roots that were so important in music. And, in fact, did you know they took a piece of the floor?
I was going to mention that.
Okay. From the Ryman.
It's a 6-foot circle.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of artists.
Will the circle be unbroken?
Exactly. A lot of artists, it's interesting, do have that reverence for playing the Ryman.
Yeah.
And it's kind of twofold. Like, it feels like it's reverential because it truly was a church.
Right.
But then it's...
You're sitting in pews with stained glass around you. Like, it's unique.
But in their mind, they're mostly speaking about the reverence for the forerunner. The forerunners of...
That's right.
...different artists that have also taken that stage. So...
Well, before we get too far, I do want to say one more thing about just the grandness of this scale of this going out. In these early years, because again, this is a long time ago... the Opry's listenership widened a lot further in 1939 when R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, that made Prince Albert smoking tobacco, they began sponsoring a half hour of the show on a 26-station NBC network.
Okay.
And so by 1952, this web had expanded to a coast-to-coast chain of 176 stations with an audience of 10 million.
Wow.
So... in the 50s, that's a lot of people.
Yeah. Wow.
Network airtime was especially important in sustaining the Opry through the 50s because other radio barn dance shows were starting to dissolve. Those, like I said, they had been kind of all over the place, but all the others are falling away.
Interesting.
And that had to do with the competition of network television, because now we have some TV stations to compete with.
Makes sense.
And radio stations, a lot of them were converting from country to rock programming.
Yeah.
But this one has stood
the
test of time. It's very special.
As I said, the Ryman was the home to the Grand Ole Opry for 31 years. The last show at the Ryman was March 13th, 1974. You mentioned they did end up bringing part of the stage over to the new location, which opened later that month in March 1974. Richard Nixon attended the opening.
So cool.
of the Opry House. And the show still, the Grand Ole Opry show does still go back to the Ryman at certain times
yes.
of the year to do a few shows. So it's kind of this seasonal thing that they do keep it in regular rotation. But the new home has been the new home since 1974. But for some reason, I feel like maybe that's something I just got from Dad. I still call it the new Opry House. I don't know why.
When I saw that it was 1974, I'm like, there is no way it's been there that long.
Yeah.
Like, I still think of it as the new place, too.
Yeah. Here.
And potentially, there's even maybe some people who've been to the Gaylord Hotel property here yep. in Nashville. It's a big property that has a riverboat and a water park and a beautiful hotel. The Opry House is right there
yes.
on that same yes. property. Okay. So I came across this most amazing gem. I've had this book for a bit, but it's called Nashville's Grand Ole Opry, The First 50 Years, 1925 to 1975.
Okay.
And I got it out to do my research. I ended up not really pulling a lot from it because it's mostly pictures.
Ooh,
it's so,
so
beautiful.
Pretty.
You're going to love looking through it. But there is an introduction that was written in 1975 by Roy Acuff.
Oh,
that
cool.
is so good
All
that
right.
I thought, let's take a little time to just read it instead of putting it in my words.
Let's hear
he's what the dude that knows more yes. about this.
What did he say?
So he starts, "There is something about our kind of music that is different from anybody else's, I've always thought. I know that none of our boys can play a violin as perfectly as people who play symphony music, and I know I could not attempt to sing a classical song. Symphony music is beautiful music. Played correctly by note. Our boys play by ear, and we slide into and slur some of the notes. But what we do is pretty to us. We put a lot of feeling into it, and we reach the hearts of our audiences. The people who watch us understand that we're not really professionals at it. They understand that we're not trained, but they also understand that what we do is part of a sort of inheritance. In a way, nobody really writes our music, you know? If we write a song, we're only writing what we felt and heard, the way we've been raised, and the way our people have lived. Those things are not created, they're inherited. And we sing them with a feeling of sincerity because they are part of ourselves. The boys and girls of the Grand Ole Opry had to come to Nashville with a hard determination to play this music. Nashville, with all its colleges and universities and high society, is a blue-blooded town, and for a long time, the elite people in the city would have liked to see the Opry destroyed and done away with it. They thought it was belittling them. They were wrong, but they had to be shown they were wrong. And I think we have finally convinced the greater part of the Nashville elite people that they were mistaken in thinking that the Opry should have been kicked out and put somewhere else, like back into the mountains. I believe the majority of the Nashville people believe, even the high society people, admire us now for the determination we've shown here. If the Opry hadn't been in Nashville, Tennessee, this city would never have become Music City, USA. The rest of the music industry would never have come here, and Nashville would have been just like any other state capital city, pretty dead. Through the Grand Ole Opry and country music, Nashville has prospered. But even today, the big tourist businesses that surround the Opry here would die if the Opry should stop operating. All the other things we've got here aren't big enough to keep the tourists coming." Now, he goes on to quote some statistics or some the numbers of people that were coming each weekend as 20,000, which I think
is just astounding
because
wish we could go back to that.
We're 15 to 20 times that now. Each weekend. But he says they don't come here to ride around the Capitol or drive by and see the Parthenon or the Country Music Hall of Fame or the Hermitage. They're coming for the Grand Ole Opry, mm-hmm. and then they go see those things in
right.
addition to.
Yes.
So there's so much good here. I don't have to read the whole thing. If you're intrigued by this topic, you should grab this book.
That is so interesting to think. What if Nashville was more just an education hub.
What right. if it was all about Vanderbilt University mm-hmm. and the Parthenon?
Yeah. What if we were, you know, however you think of Cambridge, Massachusetts, if that's like, what if that's what Nashville, Tennessee was?
Isn't that weird to think about?
That's very weird.
And another thing that I thought was fascinating, I mean, this whole thing, it's three more pages, y'all. Of the intro. And it's so good. He talks about his own story. He goes on to say, I would not have been a star. I didn't have what it takes to, you know, grab everybody's attention. Sure. It was this show that yes. helped me become a star. But some of the things that he says in here, I'm like, I can't believe he's saying that in 1975.
Yeah.
Because I would say it now, but he just had he was already seeing inklings of things
yeah.
that I can't believe it had even shown its head yet in 1975.
Yeah.
So he was already seeing it. And I think this is amazing. I love kind of towards the end of his intro, something he said. As times change, we must perform some of the other music that's around. The younger people feel they want to hear some of this music. That's sort of on the fence between country and pop and doesn't know which way to drop. That's good as long as it's presentable. But we don't want the Opry to get to playing music that you don't feel your whole family can enjoy. When you leave the Grand Ole Opry, you should be able to say to yourself that you got some good out of it. That it was maybe like going to a good church service. And I found it fascinating about, he made reference to the elite that wanted to keep the Opry out. That was touched on in Ken Burns' documentary, Country Music. Again, you should watch that if this yes. is interesting to you, because it was fantastic. But yeah, there was quite a bit of opposition from people who thought it was going to mess with the city's genteel reputation.
Make us look like hillbillies. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So interesting. Well, in 1978 is when the show began being televised. So I think it's very interesting to even think about all these years where it was just audio. Because yeah. I'm thinking about us, that it's just audio. And it is a very different representation that you and I come to the microphone with versus if we were on film. And I can see, as you were talking about that whole introduction, how that allowed for more people to participate as artists that maybe didn't have the stage presence.
I see that in every genre of music, from even if you look in the 70s.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, those were some really unattractive people.
Yeah. Yeah.
With unbelievable voices.
Right.
So would they make it now in the day of video?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I just think it's even interesting that, like, now a podcast isn't necessarily audio only. That's a lot of what is released today.
Are.
But truly, you can have a video-based podcast. Podcasts have been around for, you know, over 20 years. But in the format most of them are today, and they are so widely popular, it's yeah. just audio. So it's yeah. almost like a reversal back to,
that's
right?
So funny, yeah.
Like it's back in fashion again.
But too. See, this is what I like about listening to podcasts too, is I can be cooking food, I can be driving. I'm not missing anything. I'm just...
Not missing anything, and also not distracted by what they're wearing,
that's
how
right.
they're carrying themselves.
What does their hair look like?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there were some very big deal moments that I'm not going to give like the full history of, but I just wanted to just
throw some fun ones out.
Flash in the pan kinds of things that you've got to know to also recognize some of the significance of the Opry. Johnny Cash met June Carter at the Opry.
Wow.
Hello. Bill Monroe and his band, it's said that they invented bluegrass on the Opry stage. Okay,
wow.
That's a big deal. Elvis, hello.
I do know this story.
Most famous and successful name in modern music, he didn't actually fare very well when he appeared at the Opry in 1954, and it was his only performance at the Opry. The audience was not impressed by his rockabilly rambunctious style. That's really the bars.
They may have thought the waist down was not family friendly. I don't know.
Again, yeah. Like, distracting. But he left so mad, and he swore never to return. And who could blame him? I mean, the audience didn't respond. Why would he want to come back?
Yeah, he was used to squeals.
Even the Opry manager at the time told him to leave music forever and go back to driving a truck.
Whoa, ouch.
Yeah, so obviously Elvis didn't take his advice. And for a lot of people in whatever journey they are on, in entrepreneurial business or whatever, that was kind of the spark that really made him do it even better, do it even harder.
Right, right. You know? The teacher that told him they wouldn't become anything.
Yeah. So, but it's, those are just a few moments I wanted to mention as, but you know, what I think is so cool about this whole experience is you're reading, when you read the history of the Grand Ole Opry, it's the stars that originally played it that weren't yet stars.
Yeah, just picturing that this person is nervous and comes out with their little guitar and becomes Hank Williams or becomes. That's cool.
I mean, those are cool moments. So
it really is. And and that's, maybe you're going to get into this, but it's a unique thing, it being a show like this too, because there's, you know, announcers making, there's commercials,
right,
there's, they're just nervously standing there with their guitar waiting to come out. Props may be getting moved around a little bit, there's not a ton of that,
but
it's a unique,
it's kind of like situation. A talent show, like you know, true. A middle school, high school talent show,
you're playing at the fair or something, right? And you're coming
out.
It's
right. Like your debut. There's still so many artists every week that are making their Opry debut, and maybe they are the next Hank Williams or Roy Acuff.
I do want to read one other thing from that intro before we get off here, because I do think this is amazing too. Roy Acuff told, do you mind if I read one more thing?
Yeah, that's fine.
He was just talking about the hard work it took, especially in those early days. I mean, you're talking about, you know, the roads weren't even as good as they are now, if you think about all the travel.
Yes.
But he said, I worked every day, including Sunday, for many years. In those days, only sickness or death allowed us to be off the Opry. No matter where we were during the week, we were traveling in Fords on two-lane highways, so we couldn't get too far away. But I'd go over in the Carolinas or down in Georgia or somewhere, and I'd play my Friday night show and then come back in here for the Opry. My wife would meet me down there with my clean clothes, and I'd change at the Opry and perform and kiss her goodbye and head back to Asheville or Atlanta or somewhere for a matinee on Sunday.
Wow. Wow.
That's hard work.
Yeah. So as I mentioned in our intro, we got to sit down with Sean Dietrich recently and just, you know, touch base with him on his Opry experience. His debut was just a little over a year ago in March of 2023. And gosh, he's had two other performances since then and is making his fourth appearance this Friday, April 26th. So it just was delightful to get to hear from him as he's reflecting still on that experience. I think he is still in wonder as to how and why, and, you know, it's just a dream of his. So we sat on the porch in North Georgia Hills in the mountains, and you'll hear a creek, a stream rustling by in the background, but it was just really fun to hear from his own lips just what that experience felt like as a musician.
Okay, so let's walk back a little memory road, a little walk down memory lane. It was just about a year ago that you made your debut. Now, of course, you knew about that debut coming just maybe a couple of months before it happened.
Right. Am I allowed to say that it's all because of you and your husband? And that I thank you for altering my life? Do your listeners know that it was all because of the Franklin Theater podcast?
That's true. That's where it all came together.
We were at your theater podcast, and I met your husband, and you guys sent the letters to the Opry and made it happen. So Steel Magnolias is the reason why Sean Dietrich is on the Opry. Am I allowed to say that?
Sure. But it's been a long time coming. I know you've had a lot of people that have told you over the years,
but you
know, are Opry material.
You know how much, this is what's the most humbling about the Opry, and this is, I think, probably true. I think it's got to be true for every performer if they have any ounce of self-awareness. If you're a musician or any kind of performer, you're out there in the real world, you know how much talent is out there. Mm-hmm. There is some big, big talent. So why me? Why so-and-so when there's about 50,000 other people who are way more talented? The answer is I don't know, but I'm grateful.
What was it like actually preparing, knowing that here's the date that I'm going on the Opry, the Grand Ole Opry, for the first time in my entire life? You've written about it. You've thought about it.
So my goal when I learned that I was going to be on the Opry was not to prepare, not to do anything in any preparation, and there would be a time where I would like sit down and I'd pick up an instrument and I'd be tempted like, well, at least run through one of the songs you think you might do. No.
Really?
I stopped myself from doing it because I read this book a long time ago about mental health, written by a psychologist, and he said the more you prepare for something, the more mental real estate it takes up in your mind. And the more mental real estate it takes up in your mind, the more you're thinking about it. And the more you're thinking about it, the more anxious you allow yourself to become. And that more anxiety screws up your performance. So okay. I just had to tell myself, this is like any other performance. Because it's your performances that people like, and this is kind of what's got you here. Really what got me was Philip, but this is part of what got you here. So you have to just be that. And how can you be that if you treat this differently than you've treated all the other ones? You have to treat this just the same. These are your friends.
Yeah.
Because only your friends are going to come see you. Your enemies aren't going to buy a ticket to come see you. If they're in the audience, they're your friends.
And right.
If your friends love you, they're going to love what you do. It doesn't matter what you do. So I did not prepare until the day of when they needed a set list. They needed an actual set list. I did not know what I was going to do. So I had to go out onto the porch and figure out which three songs I was going to do. I figured them out. I took about 5 minutes doing it, and then I just forgot completely about it. I tried to forget completely about it. And when I got out to the Opry stage, what you saw was just off the cuff. Just whatever came to my brain that night.
And they needed your set list because
they were going
to
play with me.
You weren't the only one playing.
Right.
They were playing with you.
Right.
And these are world-class musicians,
right?
And they needed to learn the music if they didn't know it. And I'm sure they're oftentimes handed original songs that they don't know at all.
Exactly. And so during sound check, we just ran through the tunes that I knew that I was going to do. And so I built the dialogue and storytelling around that. And that's how it went. It was great.
Did you feel like they were your band? Or did you feel like I'm stepping into songs with them?
Well, for me, this was maybe the coolest moment. This was the coolest moment. And this isn't going to sound right to a lot of people's ears. Because I think maybe you have to be a musician to get it or understand it. But I'll start by saying there's this huge lore around Nashville musicians that they are just better, you know, and it's the same way in New York. New York musicians are supposed to be just better, and California better, but Nashville in particular. And I've watched guys will go to like a jam, you know, and if somebody comes in from Nashville, everybody just kind of gives this guy his space like he's just the king of the world. And so it makes you feel really underconfident. But I've had a long career as a musician. I've played as a musician since I was legitimately 14 years old professionally and did it full time and anyway, blah, blah, blah. So, but I still got there to the Opry and I knew I was going to be playing with world-class players and I became nervous. But when I got up onto the stage for the sound check, and we did a sound check, and I moved over to the piano, and I've been playing piano all my life. I played, and I listened to them play, and I was evaluating their musicianship like they were evaluating mine, I'm sure. And I remember thinking, well, these guys are good, but I've played with guys this good before, and I've played with guys probably even better, and they've certainly played with guys better than me. We're on the same page. Oh, my God. I don't not belong here. For that moment, I felt that way. And I got so excited about it, I called my friend. a drummer who I've been playing with, who's a kind of a mentor to me. He's one of the greatest drummers that I've ever known. And I said, his name's Fred. I said, Fred, I just did a sound check at the Opry, and I was nervous, and you're a better drummer than he is. And I said, I mean, he's really good, but you're as good as this guy is, and I can't believe it. I feel like I'm not just some hack. And thank you, Fred, for helping me grow and feel that way, because I could never have felt that way on the stage unless I'd have spent a lifetime playing with you.
Mm-hmm. And we cried, what a compliment
we
for
cried,
him.
We cried on the phone together. It was like, yeah, man.
Wow.
So I don't know if that came off right, but
yeah, for sure. I just didn't know if you felt like a stand-in, I guess.
No, they played really well, and it was like playing with any other group of really good musicians. They were intuitive. It was just, and I was just proud. I was proud to look over and see that Tommy White playing steel guitar, because he's maybe the best there ever was. Yeah. I always wanted to say his name, and I said that on the Opry after I sang my first verse. I looked over and said it to the mic. I said, I've been waiting a long time to say this. Ladies and gentlemen, Tommy White. And he just, what a great feeling.
It sounded so good, and that made it feel like this is a band.
Oh.
That's played together their whole lives, yeah, right? When you're just calling out players.
Well, I wanted to know everybody's name in the band. Mm-hmm. And they were surprised by that. I wanted to know everybody's name so that I could introduce them because I wanted everybody to take a solo. And they were like, well, we do this. No one ever cares about our names. And they even said that. But it was really important to me that it wasn't just, you know, that I was part of that band.
Yeah.
Not just the front guy.
Yeah.
It's stupid, probably. I mean, but I wanted to do that.
Yeah. So tell me about, like, the experience getting there, walking in through the backstage artist entrance. What were some things you observed? What was kind of going through your mind? Did you notice anything that was interesting? Or
it's like touching a stove. When you touch the stove, and for that first brief moment, you don't feel anything. Just a strong, bright sensation, whatever it is. You're not real sure what it is. It's just there's that moment before the pain sets in. That's kind of how it was. It was just this slap of what is happening. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't feel anything yet. I know this is happening to me because my senses are telling me we're parking in that artist spot. My name's printed on the metal, and we're walking in all together. And there's the, you know, Grand Ole Opry insignia everywhere, and you walk in, and the first thing you're greeted with is a picture of Minnie Pearl to your left and Roy Acuff to your right. And Roy is holding his fiddle and looking at an audience and a huge oil painting. And then there's Minnie Pearl, and she's doing her act, and it's a big oil painting of her, or photograph maybe, and on canvas. And you walk past those metal detector, and the guy greets you, and he knows your name, and he's a security guard, and that's just, none of it feels real. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these trophies and memorabilia on the walls, and they say, here's your dressing room, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Really? And the rest of the night is just a big blur.
Yeah.
You look in the mirror, and they tell you that Dolly Parton used to change in this room, and you're thinking, my cup's runneth over.
I did think it was cool. They always give anyone making their debut appearance the same dressing room, right?
That's neat. I heard that too.
That very first dressing room, when you go through a corridor of, I don't know, upwards of like 14 or 15 dressing rooms that take up the backstage area. And the quotes on the wall, this is just stuff I remember them mentioning, were all quotes that people made the night they made their debut.
Oh, wow.
So, and pictures.
Yes.
Of artists. The night they made their debut. And some of them looked really young.
Yes,
and
that was.
Some made their debut older and, you know.
That was very interesting to me, like to see a picture of Vince Gill when he's like a baby up there, and all of them. And it does, that's when it really, you know, starts to sink in.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, I'm really here. Yeah. And this is where this stuff really happened.
Yeah.
There was a picture on my dressing room wall of Porter Wagoner, and I'm thinking, stop it. This can't be real. Yeah. This cannot be real.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of there's a lot of activity happening back there. You hear music coming from the dressing rooms. You know, you can hear the bluegrass groups warming up, and you can hear people clicking by your rooms dressed in their peacock outfits, and like you have no idea what they're thinking. And there's a TV going in your room, and it's broadcasting the operator the whole time, and you feel this adrenaline coursing through your veins the whole time, even if you're not performing. Because this is what people have told me, because it's just all back there. That adrenaline is just going back there.
And it's live on the radio.
Yeah.
So, you know, like...
Yeah.
There can't be mistakes or real big snafus or, you know?
Yeah. Like, they got to pull it together.
Yeah.
And I went back there the second time maybe. And that was when Bill Anderson was standing back there to watch me go on, because he just finished. And I could not believe he was going to watch me go on and watch my set. And I think he's 83? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, congratulations on being here at the Grand Ole Opry, son. And I said, I don't belong here. I said, and I feel like every time I come, it's going to be my last time. He said, son, I've been feeling that way for 65 years.
Wow.
He was so nice to me.
He was.
And not all the performers are, I will add. The newer generation performers, some of them, they act very differently than the older generation. The older generation performers, you can tell old country music, that they are from old country music world where they really were country people.
Yeah.
And they came from humble beginnings.
Yeah.
You can tell that in a person by the way they act, their demeanor. And you can tell that difference with the Generation Z and Millennial country.
We just love him. Sean Dietrich, Sean of the South.
I even love that it's only because of this podcast that we even know Sean. We did interviews with him and did a live podcast with him, and the rest, as they say, is history. And it was an honor for us to play the role that we got to play in his journey to the Opry. He has written about it a lot. In fact, I'm going to probably put a few links in our show notes of some of his pre-debut on the Opry. I'm talking about like experiences as a child, as a young boy, his wanting to be on the Opry he went with his father. I mean, it's just, he's had lots of
full circle moments for him. And this was a full circle moment for us.
It was really, I felt like I was in the right place walking in with him backstage. Didn't you?
So fun. Absolutely.
Like, we've grown up our whole lives here in Nashville and never
gotten to do that.
Yeah.
And so, wouldn't pick anybody else I'd want to do it with.
That's so true. There are tours that you can actually do of the Opry itself. They even take you into the backstage area. So I wanted to mention that if for any reason you're in town and you're not getting to see the show, or you want to make the show even more, you can check that out. And then there are so many ways to listen or watch or both. So
and people watch from all over the world. This isn't just like a USA thing.
Right. Yeah. So some of the ways that you can tune in or catch the broadcast, you can obviously listen on the radio, 650 WSM AM, if you're in the vicinity that reaches. There's even an Opry mobile app. There is.
Of course there is.
Sirius XM, satellite radio. You can get the Grand Ole Opry show. I mean, there are lots of ways that you... So if you can't get here to experience it live, I got your back.
That is just some good American history right there. It is.
And I just love that even with COVID, they didn't stop the longest running radio show.
So great.
In America.
Okay, y'all. Add that to your bucket list.
All right. I told you I was charged up and ready to talk about
Add
this.
Add that. Tune in where you want to, and peace be with y'all.
You've just listened to an episode of the Steel Magnolias Podcast, an independent show funded solely on support from listeners like you and a few advertisers from time to time. For reminders of what we just said and links to what we just mentioned, take a look at the description of this episode. They are right there. Are you enjoying the show? We hope you'll text a friend or loved one to tell them about this podcast.
and make sure they know how to get to a podcast first. We invite you to join our mailing list to be the first to know about episodes, giveaways, and events. Sign up at steelmagnoliaspodcast.com.